Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 41. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. I'm pretty excited about today's interview, and it was a lot of work to get today's guest on the show. But, like I said, I'm very excited about having him on. One of the factions that controls nearly every moment of our lives is hardly understood by the majority of the population. To gain an understanding of today's topic deepens our understanding of the world and how it works and exactly what we can do to affect change when and where needed. If someone wanted to cut down a tree, does it behoove them to hack at the leaves and the branches at the top of the tree one by one, or should they go after the trunk of the tree and the roots? To have an understanding of tree biology helps to get the job done quickly and efficiently. For if the tree were large enough, and excuse the analogy, but say an old redwood tree, one could potentially hack at the tree most of their lives at the branches and the needles or leaves and never bring the tree down. Such is the way with political reform, revolution, and change. People protest the New World Order, they protest the government, the wars, fuel prices, universal health care, the IMF, and the World Bank, and all sorts of injustices. But are these acts of protesting attacking the roots and trunk of the tree, or are they attacking the leaves and the branches of the proverbial New World Order tree? And after only 8 months, I think we can already say with certainty that Obama has failed as president. He's failed in everything that he set out to do. He's working for the bankers, and I think we can chalk him up as another bought and paid for president. But how can I say that for certain already? Our deepening investigation into the freedom of consciousness cannot go without a deeper understanding of what we all use for exchange or trade, which is money. Exactly how we define the word money defines our very society and affects nearly every facet of our lives. It also tells us exactly what we can expect from our political representatives. All we need to do is to understand the language of money. Beginning today in this detailed two-part series, we begin to look at the fundamental concepts of money. What is money and how is it defined? What is the history of money? How does it tie to religion, government, and private business? What is the difference between credit and money? What is fiat money? Is there a difference between private versus nationalized banks and how they operate? And why is any of this important to you? And how could it possibly affect your life? A few months ago, I interviewed G. Edward Griffin, and after the show, a listener sent me an email regarding tonight's guest and even sent me a copy of his book to make sure that I read it and had him on the show because there is really more to the story that we need to understand. Stephen Zerlinga is the founder of the American Monetary Institute, which is the leading American monetary think tank for monetary history, theory, and reform. And Stephen is probably one of the best economic historians in the country, if not the best, and if, in fact, if not the world. And he's also an author, and Stephen provides us the clearest picture of how money and monetary systems work in his 2002 tome, The Lost Science of Money. And he is also the author of the American Monetary Act, submitted to Congress this last March by Dennis Kucinich. And I never thought a book on economics could be so intriguing, but Stephen's book actually held my interest throughout its nearly 700 pages. And if you want to have the deepest understanding possible about the New World Order and how it works and what you can do to stop it, read Zarlinga's book. I cannot emphasize that enough. And please distribute this talk and part two when it comes out next month as well. Make sure that you are looking for that and send that out. Upcoming shows. September, we've got Daniel Siebert, who will be discussing Salvia Divinorum. Dr. Richard Tarnas, who is the author of Passion of the Western Mind, as well as other books. And Stephen Zarlinga, Part 2 from the American Monetary Institute. And also Dr. Ellen Brown, the author of Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. And also David Icke, and I'm still trying to get James Orrick on the show to discuss his new book, Tryptamine Palace, which I just received in the mail today, thanks to his publisher, which is Park Street Press. So thank you, everybody over there at Park Street and Inner Traditions, who publishes many books on entheogens and the history of entheogenic studies, etc. This episode is brought to you by Matthew, and thank you for your donation to help bring us this episode this week. Also, thanks to Mark for his generous donation this week to get us a new printer, in fact, a laser printer. Our printer died as I was printing copies of a manuscript, and his timing could not have been better. Mark, thank you so much for that, and thanks for helping us keep this project on target, which is the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And this show is listener-sponsored. If you enjoy this show and talk about it and share it with your friends and family, please donate. It is your support we need. Many of the projects and shows that we do here at Gnostic Media do need your support, and our ability to release them in a timely fashion are directly related to the topic of tonight's show, which is money. And we can still use more volunteers for the transcripts. Please contact me right away on that. And to help support this show, you can also go to the Gnostic Media website and order a copy of my DVD or one of my books, or also check out the She Who Remembers or SWR audio archives. And Astrotheology and Shamanism, the color, numbered, and signed edition. I've got about 25 copies of that left. If you would like one of those, get one now. And you can also get ANS in black and white if you would rather. Also, my book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, is available and does go out autographed in appreciation for your support, as I say every week. And lastly, the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by the host of this show or Gnostic Media. If you'd like to check out more, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com or contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. Thanks for listening. All right, Stephen, it's nice to have you on the show, and welcome.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Oh, you're welcome.
Am I saying your name right?
Yeah, that's correct. Good. And this is Gnostic Media podcast number 41.
Oh.
And so tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, my background is in at the University of Chicago, psychology graduate, and went to work in the financial services industry for a lot of years, and had a background in the gold area. I was in charge of marketing the main gold mutual fund, a fund concentrating in gold, and that was from 1970 through 75. We had gold go from basically from $38 to $200 an ounce during that period, so we did very well. And I understood that gold was going to go up at that point in time, and people did very well being in gold. So I did publishing, and in 1990, and I worked on the Financial Futures Exchange. You can see all this on the back of my book, The Lost Science of Money. You can see where I've been. And began to do that research in 91, I believe it was, and thought that with that background, in the financial area, I might have to read 15 or 20 books, and I'd have all the everything set up and fill any gaps in my knowledge. Well, about 800 monetary source materials later and 12 years, it was done. And approximately 300-400 of those, of the better sources, made it into the bibliography of the book. And that's the first thing that you must do, Jan, in reading any, or anyone, in reading any book on money. Start with the bibliography. Make sure that the person writing the book has earned the right to ask you to read it.
And
so then in 96, I was a co-founder of the American Monetary Institute, and it's the leading think tank on, American think tank on monetary history, theory, and reform. And we hold a monetary reform conference every year beginning in 2005. We're having our fifth annual conference this September 24th through 27th in downtown Chicago at Roosevelt University. And any of your listeners, they still have time to get in on this. They should go to our website, monetary.org, and they'll see, they can find the registration forms. And there's a one of the lines on the website is called 2009 schedule. That shows you a picture of the people that are expected to speak and their backgrounds and the titles of their talks.
Great. And that sounds like a very...
Come on in, Jan. Come on in to the conference.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm in California and funds are a little bit tight right now. So
that's true. It is a problem for everybody right now, thanks to the mess that's been created by our present banking and monetary system.
And all the more reason to have you on my show so that we can discuss exactly what's going on behind the scenes here.
Yeah.
And if you would, please define what the word money means, or what is money?
Define money. Well, it's interesting that that's the key question, you know, that economists avoid. They generally don't define money. They leave it, either they assume a definition or they misdefine it. But it's so important to have the proper concept of money. I'm looking it up exactly in my book. It takes me 656 pages to define money. And here I am. Now, here's the section, what it's called. Money's nature must dictate monetary reform. Readers should now understand what money is, what it is we're reforming. We've noted our inheritance from past genius. And the first 23 chapters of the book go through all of these case studies from Aristotle forward. From Aristotle, money, quote, money exists not by nature but by law. From Plato, quote, a money token for purposes of exchange. From Julius Paulus, he was what they had as lawyers for the Roman Empire in 300 AD, I believe it was. From Paulus, quote, this device being officially promulgated, circulated, and maintained its purchasing power, not so much from its substance as from its quantity. Then a long darkness, and from a spiritual person, George Berkeley, Anglican Bishop of Coin Ireland, who Berkeley University is named after, quote, whether the true idea of money as such be not altogether that of a ticket or counter. John Locke and Ben Franklin viewed money as a pledge for wealth rather than wealth itself. And then I think really the most comprehensive definition comes from Alexander Del Mar. Quote, what is commonly understood as money has always consisted tangibly of a number of pieces of some material marked by public authority, named or understood in the laws or customs, that its palpable characteristic, mark of authority, its essential characteristic, possession of value defined by law, and its function, the legal power to pay debts and taxes, and the mechanical power to facilitate the exchange of other objects possessing value. That's really thorough and complete. From George Knapp, quote, about 1905, our test that the money is accepted in payments made to the state offices And then we give you our definition, our simplified American Monetary Institute definition. We accept these concepts and add money's essence, apart from whatever's used to signify it, is an abstract social power embodied in law as an unconditional means of payment. Now, Jan, you asked the right question, because the way in which a society defines money will determine who controls the society's money system. And that's important, because whoever controls the money system, over time, they will control the nation. Not every year, but over time. Now, what we've learned, and why is that important? We know that we can trace it at least to Aristotle's time. There's a battle over the control of money. There is an ongoing battle, and the dividing line in the battle has always been the same. From that time through all of American history to the present, the dividing line is, will the money power be privately controlled, and then it'll benefit the few, or will it be publicly controlled to benefit the many? That's the dividing line. I'll keep going.
Please.
Now, in this battle, and it's a battle of life and death.
It is.
Finally, and people don't understand this. In this battle, the way you define money determines who's in charge. For example, if you define money as wealth, then the wealthy will control not only their property, they will control the money system, which can be used to accumulate and concentrate much more property. So Aristotle's definition does not define money as wealth. Money exists not by nature, but by law. Money is an abstract legal power. Okay? Now, so if you define money as wealth, you lose. The wealthy gain power to control the money system, and that means the society. We used to define money as wealth, gold and silver. That's over now. With the founding of the Federal Reserve, especially some British, propagandists came in and began the switch to what money is. It's really credit. Okay.
Right.
But if you define money as credit, then the people who deal in credits, the lenders, they're going to control your money system. And today that is the way all countries of the world define money. They define it as credit. And therefore, the bankers, who are the main dealers in that, they're in control of the money system. Properly, now, what your listeners, all 2 million of them, as you told me, they have to understand that money and credit are two very different things. That's why we have different names for them. If you properly define money, and this is what my whole book does, the examples are fascinating, but this is one of the great accomplishments of this book. It hasn't been done before. If you properly define money with the Aristotelian concept of money, money exists not by nature, but by law, as an abstract social power, then it's possible to place it, not guaranteed, but it becomes possible to place it under our system, our constitutional system of checks and balances. Obviously, there needs to be governmental power over this, and in fact, it is in our Constitution that our government has the power to control money. Unfortunately, they've delegated it. It's been usurped. It's been privatized, and that's at the bottom of virtually all our problems except the deeper spiritual problems that we have. I have spoken.
So, Stephen, why would you say that most economists are wrong in their definition of money?
Well, the economists are primarily defining money as credit. They don't examine it. They really don't examine it. Alexander Del Mar told us why. He did this about 100 years ago. He said, as a rule, economists don't take the trouble to study the history of money. It's much easier to imagine it and deduce the principles of this imaginary knowledge, unquote. In other words, they're working on theory. They're working on theory, and they're ignoring the facts. They're not using an empirical method, which is so necessary to do. It's all theoretical, and as they pushed more and more into theory, they've ended up now at mathematics, because that's where you get to pure theory, is in math. And it just does not work. The theories are not based. There's no real support for them. And I'm including even their most basic theory, like the law of supply and demand. I gave a talk, Jan, to a group of philosophers at Radford University in 04, and I suggested to them that as philosophers, as the guardians of knowledge, it was well within their jurisdiction, or that they had standing to remove, to declare that economics is not a science, pending improvement in definitions and methodology, that they should decertify economics as a science. And I still maintain that even more so. So what you get in universities, first of all, you have to understand what happens with economists. Why are they mistrained? They're mistrained because it begins in the universities, number one. And then they stay mistrained because of the paychecks that they're getting from the financial establishment. And everybody needs that to survive. The whole society is on a survival mode.
And then it's
so
a trap.
Understand how it happens that affects their minds. They're not necessarily saying, this is not true, but I'm going to do it anyway because it's evil. This is evil. I'm going to do it anyway because I need the money for me and my family. They're not saying that. They're just letting their minds be misused and abused. They're letting themselves be, and I'm going to censor this for you. They're letting themselves be mind bleeped.
Yeah. Well, this is an internet show, so do feel free to speak freely.
Well, that's free enough.
I'm not.
And I like some economists. We have them at our conference. We have some good ones at our conference. There are good economists, as in every profession. There's a lot of bad and some good. And the thing is, you have to sort them out. You cannot just take the degree as meaning anything, because it is meaningless in terms of understanding and figuring out what to do. What I've written in chapter 24, the book goes like this. It's the Lost Science of Money book, chapter 1 through 23, case histories of money. And it's focusing on money almost entirely, and some spiritual stuff also.
To interrupt you real quick, I was very impressed how you wove religious history and anthropology and all of these different things together to make your case, and I applaud you for...
Thank you, Jan. Thank you so much. And, it's wonderful. An author, when he has a reader who really understands what he wrote, it's just such a good feeling.
Well, you're welcome, and as an author myself, I know what you mean, and that's why I always try to take the time to read the books of each guest before they're on. Sometimes it becomes very difficult time-wise, but I think it's a necessity.
Thank you. Now, chapter 24 then says, okay, those first 23 chapters, that tells us what we should know about money. What does that mean we should do today and to fix the problem? And chapter 24 then applies it to the present, and it comes up with one program that has three elements in it, all of which have to be done for it to work. And the program is, I'll get to that in a moment. The three elements are, first, to put the Federal Reserve System into the U.S. Treasury. make it a part of the government so that it is within our system of checks and balances. Whatever the problems with our system of checks and balances, it's the best we have, and we can improve it. You need to put it under this constitutional system. You put the Federal Reserve, which people think is part of the government, it's not, but okay, let's make it part of the government, put it into the Treasury, number one. Number two, you stop the banks from creating our money supply. People think our money is created by the government. It's not. It's created when the banks make loans. They're loaning money that they're creating out of thin air.
Yeah, isn't the only money coming from the federal government are coins?
Well, the coins are, yeah, and to a degree the paper money, but even that is tied in with debt. And mainly, only the government should be creating money. But today, in our system, when the banks make loans, in effect, most of it is created money. Now, that has to stop. And there are people out there who pretend to be for reform, thinking, well, I won't name names. They are saying, well, let the banks create half the money and the government the other half. And what we know from history, Jan, is that that doesn't work. The Bank of England did that, and when they nationalized the Bank of England in the 1940s, just after World War II. And you may remember from the book, at the end of chapter 20, it was the Archbishop of Canterbury,
right,
who brought that about. And that shows the relationship of good religion and the money system. The Anglicans have a really good monetary history in general. Bishop George Berkeley, he was also an Anglican. Anyway, Catholics have a good monetary history too, and some other religions. Now, so you stop the banks from creating any money. You don't even let them create 10% of it, because if they can do 10, they're smart enough to get 20. If they can do 20% of it, they'll get 40 and 50. And what happened in England, at this point in time, the banks are creating 97% of all of England's money, in spite of the fact that the Bank of England was nationalized. So we know from experience that that doesn't work. And so in our American Monetary Act, I'll tell you how that got started. The second element, banks no longer create any money. It's immoral. You can't expect them to create money for any other purpose than to help themselves. That's just the way it'll work. And so what'll happen? They will concentrate wealth over time. It doesn't happen immediately. It takes a few decades. But they'll concentrate wealth to what can only be described as obscene levels that we have now. Billions are being stolen under cover of law for doing nothing, for harming the society. People are getting paid in proportion to the amount of damage they do. Look at Rush Limbaugh.
Very good example.
Yeah.
Well,
so now, if you just did those two things, you would probably create trouble. You'd create a deflation. And most monetary reform in the past has been deflationary. And so, again, we learn from history. This is not theory. This is, well, it turns out to be logical, but it's based on experience, on empirical stuff. And the third thing is the government starts to simply print and spend new money into circulation to pay for infrastructure. Now, infrastructure repair. It can either be printed on paper or it can be inserted on an account. But the key is, it's not debt. It's money that's spent into circulation. You start with the $2.2 trillion that the engineers, American Society of Civil Engineers, tell us is needed for keeping the infrastructure safe or partly safe over the next 5 years. Everybody wants the infrastructure, Jan. They just say, yeah, we want it, but how do we afford it? How can we pay for it? The American Monetary Act can do that, and it's this is so important. You cannot build the hardware unless you've got intelligent, healthy people. So we include human infrastructure of healthcare and education under infrastructure. That's it. It's that simple. You got to do all three. Doing any one or any two doesn't work. You must do all three. You must do them all together. And then humanity can move back from the brink of nuclear disaster, from rule by fraud and ugliness to a world of beauty and justice. That's it. What we did after we finished Chapter 24, I asked a friend at the Treasury if he'd write it up into language of legislation, and that's what the American Monetary Act is. And you can see that it's still in development. It will continue to be until the Congress finalizes it. And it's at our website, which is at monetary.org. You can find that link from the website.
Well, let's go back a step. Since you're discussing money being produced by the banks versus being produced by the government, so I think what we need here is a definition of usury and what that means and how
usury,
it applies.
Yeah, that's an important question and topic. Today, tell me how usury is defined.
Oh, I guess it would be interest.
Taking too much interest.
Okay.
That's a misdefinition that was palmed off onto us by Jeremy Bentham. He also happens to be the guy who promoted, what's it called?
UNICEF? I don't know.
The term means don't worry about the morality of what we're doing.
Oh.
Unitarian. No.
Oh, yeah.
Utilitarian.
Yeah, there you go.
Utilitarianism is what he promoted. And what it means is don't worry about the morality. Just look whether it works or not. Okay. And the problem with that is that this is a highly moral area. The control of the money system and what you do with money, it's a life and death question. And his misdefinition of usury was an important part of getting us into this trouble. He just defined it as taking more interest or too much interest or more interest than is customary. And then by page 9 of his book, which was called In Defense of Usury, by page 9, he says, well, that never really happens. There's nothing that's customary. So he defines usury out of existence on page 9, if you're reading it carefully. Anyway, the way that we have resurrected the definition of usury, and it's interesting that on the Bill Moyers show, in an interview with William Grider did this too. Usury is an antisocial misuse of the money mechanism for private gain. It's much more than just interest rates. The entire derivatives nonsense is all usury in the real sense. The theft that has been going on Wall Street and in the banks, it's theft. It's not economics. It's not really business dealing. It's kleptocracy. And this has become dominant in our system. And that will happen when you take morality out of economics. You see, aside from bad definitions and bad methodology, the economists have done something horrible, and they are proud of it. They tell us we've removed all what they call normative values from our science. By normative values, they mean morality. Now, if they were straight talking and said, we've removed morality from our science, people would say, what? But when you're removing the normative values, people don't know what it means. So that's another problem with economics.
In your book, you discuss nomisma. What is nomisma? Yeah, what is that, and why is it important to understand?
Nomisma, it's important. Nomisma. That was a term that's under Aristotle. That was the term for money in Greece when Aristotle was there, and that's the term he used, nomisma. And the interesting thing is the word for law or binding custom in Greek was nomos, N-O-M-O-S. So it's a demonstration of the closeness of the money system to the legal system. And remember Aristotle's concept of money, is what we call the science of money. Money exists not by nature, but by law. It's an abstract social, an abstract legal power embedded in law. We consider some of the money that America issued as nomisma. The name of my book, The Lost Science of Money, comes about because the science is discovered, and then a society will develop using that concept of money, and then it gets corrupted, and it degenerates and falls into corruption, and the society falls around it, and later another society will rediscover the science of money. And so I call the book The Lost Science of Money. It's been discovered and lost and rediscovered several times. Greece, Rome, a couple of cases in the Middle Ages, and most importantly in America in 1694. Anyway.
Go ahead.
Yeah. You have a follow-up question on that?
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you if you would discuss fiat money or fiat currency.
Oh, yeah. Well, the key thing is money by its nature is a fiat. That's what Aristotle's definition means. It's a fiat of the law. To consider money as a thing, then you're getting back to the misdefinition of money as wealth, for example, gold or silver. And that does not really give the society the ability to use money to advance the society properly, because, again, the wealth is going to be in other hands. So the actual nature of money being fiat, all money is ultimately, all real money is fiat money. And quite often, even when gold and silver are money, it's because of the law that they are money, and their value is often a question of the law, not of any commodity value. Now, I sympathize very much with the Rand Paul people who look at this and they say, well, fiat money is a bad thing, and I would just offer this one little suggestion to them.
Private.
That it's not fiat money that is the problem. It's the private creation of fiat money that is a horrendous problem, because then it acts like a private tax placed on all of us to our detriment, to the benefit of those who can issue the fiat money. That's the only thing I'd ask them to look at. And when they do, they understand. Rand Paul people are pretty smart on monetary matters.
So what do you say to those who support the gold and or silver-backed money system?
Well, first thing I would say, congratulations. You understand there's a real problem with our money system, and you're asking for a change. And the second thing I would say is examine the nature of money, take a real look, and understand then the nature of money, and then you'll understand what can be done, what has to be done to reform it.
And from your book, is there any place in history where the use of gold or silver for money did not lead to enslavement of the society?
Oh, not that I've seen. There may be short periods of time when it worked, but the problem with gold and silver is never enough. You see, the supply in gold and silver does not increase fast, aside from not being the correct view. It's impractical because there's never enough of it. It never keeps pace with population growth or commerce growth. And so what happens is that all the past, virtually all of the past gold and silver systems, had to cheat. They had to include paper, private bank paper, with in circulation with the gold and silver. And this bank paper pretended to be convertible into gold, but it wasn't, you see. And that's how they cheated. And the systems could function for a few decades until a crisis occurred, and then in a crisis, people take their paper promises and they want the metal, and it's not there.
Modern day bank run.
Yeah, yeah, modern day. Or, and that's true for gold or silver. The silver's been done with games, unfortunately, that have been played on people. You've heard of some of them pretending to back some private paper stuff with silver. It's not there. They're going to find it's not there when it's all fully audited.
Is inflationary money really an issue as people make it out to be, or what's the real issue with inflation?
Inflation can definitely be a problem. Understand that it's mostly been a problem when money is privately controlled by the banks, because they do it with this fractional reserve system where they issue money without having the reserves for it. They're in effect creating it out of thin air. And it doesn't have to be a problem if the money is created by government and goes into real things. See, much depends on where the money goes. If money is created and it goes into production of goods and services, well, the reason inflation is not such a horrendous problem is that you end up with goods and services available, and that will hold prices down. On the other hand, what the banking establishment has traditionally done is put money into junk because it's easy. And the bigger the junk, the fewer people have to examine it and make a decision for multimillion-dollar loans. They've concentrated on bubbles, whether it's been New York Stock Exchange bubbles, Wall Street bubbles, the latest one. Well, we had another. The latest one is, of course, the real estate bubble. And then it will be highly inflationary on the area in which it's focused. You see?
Right.
Now, that's been, unfortunately, the history of banking. Government tends to spend money more directly onto things that are of concern to the public. Education, roads, infrastructure. Unfortunately, some of it's been spent on warfare, too, and that has to be controlled. That has to be stopped. And that's going to be a spiritual matter to stop that, and as well as a political matter. But that can be stopped, too. And the thing is, if you remove the motivation to create money, if you remove the warfare reason to create money, and the warfare reason is, oh, if there's a war, the government has to borrow, and they'll have to pay us interest because they'll have no choice but to borrow to pay for their war. You remove that motivation for war by eliminating the need to borrow, with the government being able to issue its own money, simply create it. You have eliminated a motivation for warfare, a big one, and that's good.
And not only that, but you eliminate the possibility of banks funding both sides of the war, which has been...
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That's right. Which is even further motivation. Jan, the guys in charge of our money system, they allowed this world crisis to occur out of total stupidity. Now they're pretending that, oh, no one could foresee this. Lots of people foresaw it. at our conference, one of our speakers gave it in great detail 2.5 years ago.
Well, I think, didn't Thomas Jefferson even predict it?
Oh, he did a lot of things, but I don't know if he predicted this far ahead.
well, I mean, you know, the
oh, yeah. Oh,
you know,
that's
predicting
right.
The takeover.
The under of, the hammer.
Right.
Yeah, he did do that. Now, the thing about Thomas Jefferson, you should realize, you can get Jefferson to say almost anything from his quotes, because he went through a period of development where he started at gold and silver money, as most people do. And so if you take quotes from that period, you can support gold and silver stuff. But then if you take all these quotes, and as I do in the book, in chapter, I think, 13 or 14, you put them in time order, in chronological order, and you can the development of his thought becomes obvious to the point where he finally arrives at the real concept of money. Tom Paine never quite got that far. He starts with the gold and silver, and then he's developing and developing. And when you read his book, Agrarian Justice, you can see, if you understand money, you can see he's just on the verge. He could, you know, if he just thought for two more minutes on that last paragraph, he would have got it. But he didn't quite get there. Almost. Almost. And he, of course, was one of the greatest Americans, father of the Revolution. And he understood that the continental currency, government created money out of thin air, was the key. He called it a cornerstone of the bridge that carried us over. All that's in the book.
Let's go back to gold and silver for a minute. If you could help clarify for me, what are gold and silver values based on? Are they based on law or free market values? And what are the current current flaws in measuring the value of gold?
Okay, I'm going to give you an actual example here too. They're based on both. Okay, to an extent, the gold and silver market price is a factor. For example, if you're looking at the 900 at wherever it is, it's a bit over 900. That's a market price. And hold on, I'm just bringing up something that's going to give on my computer here to go into great detail. Okay. I'll bring up this one. On the other hand, they're based very much on the law. For example, during the Great Depression, price of gold was, at the beginning of the Depression, was $20.67 an ounce. Okay? And then with the Depression, the value of everything plunged, in the sense of the value of stocks plunged, the value of real estate plunged, everything plunged, but gold was fixed by law. So it was still $20.67 an ounce. All right. Then, legally, Roosevelt raised the price of gold to $35 an ounce by law. All right. So at that point, gold was $35 an ounce. And anyone who had gold, and people were allowed to hold up to 5 ounces of it at that point in time, which probably almost nobody had, they got the benefit of that. Now, to demonstrate the legal determination of the value of gold and silver, silver had been demonetized, meaning it was no longer protected by law, the price. So silver, during the Depression, it fell from $1.38 an ounce in 1919, and I had to get this up on the screen here because I couldn't remember the numbers. It fell from $1.38 an ounce in 1919 down to 44 cents an ounce in 1932. It was unprotected by law. It plunged. Gold was protected by law at 20 and then raised to 35. So there is a question. Both of them can be a factor, the law and sometimes the market price. Problem with the market price, it can be manipulated. They can get people all excited. Oh, go and buy this. Oh, gold's going to 2,000, whatever. And it can be like the oil market, phony.
Well,
but it's hard. It's hard to do that. So
yeah.
The answer to your question is that they're both a factor. And right now, gold has been making a pattern. Oh, by the way, at our website, people can see my interview with Gold Newsletter in the year 2000, where we did predict that gold would go up. And at that point, it was $272 an ounce. at one of our recent seminars privately. We're not an investment agency. We don't give investment advice, but privately we told people at one of our, well, it was public, one of our conferences, sell it now that it's at 1,000. And if they did that, then it dropped down to 670 from there, this about a year ago, and it's come back up to 900. It got up to 1,000 again, and now it's at 930. So we told them, sell half your gold. You're riding free with the other half if you followed our advice from 272. You can't get hurt. In fact, you got out with a double your money no matter what. And right now, gold is in a pattern that is going to push it either strongly up for a few hundred bucks, or it'll come crashing down. It's a kind of a triangle pattern. I know about this from my years on the futures exchange, where we had to do this kind of charting. Depending how it breaks out of this triangle, it'll go up strongly or down very strongly. And I'm thinking it's going to be down, because when you look at the Commodity Research Bureau index of commodities, that price dropped 50%, and it's still way down there.
What about the hidden costs in the valuation of gold, like warfare and slavery and murder and all of those sorts of things?
Yeah. Gold has been associated with with a lot of murder. And the best known example, though not discussed, is when the Spaniards conquered the South and Central American Indians and took their centuries of accumulated gold from them. They stole it, and we've got the actual tonnage of how much they stole at gunpoint and took over to Europe. Now, when they did that, the Brits and the Dutch, the Spanish did the dirty work on the ground. The Brits and the Dutch intercepted them at sea and managed to get much of the gold, at least half of it. Now, there was one group of people. I'm not going to call it a tribe. It's more of a nation. You know, you like to call these groups of 6 million people tribes. That's silly. They're nations. This one group, and it was not that big, but they saw what the Spaniards were doing to them, and they actually made the choice to stop having children. They tried to starve them out, and that didn't work. They tried to starve the Spaniards, and it didn't work because they managed to get whatever they were growing anyway. So they finally decided, we're not going to subject children to this kind of treatment. And that's a horrible thing. Even in America, in the 1800, 1849, and so on, they wiped out an Indian, let's call it a small nation or a large tribe, that was in that area. They disappeared. They were killed, murdered. Gold has always been associated with this kind of bloody activity, and it's beneath mankind. It's beneath the human species. We're better than that if we are going to have a future. If we're going to do that kind of thing, I regard it as a sort of a test of humanity, whether we're really supposed to be the ones in charge of this planet or not. We've come close to wiping out everything. In 1962, McNamara told us the only thing that saved us from an all-out nuclear exchange with Russia was blind luck. He did that he mentioned that. He said that. I saw him saying it in a documentary on the war called The Fog of War. People don't know that it happened again. I think in 83, or it might have been 87, I can't remember the year, a Russian colonel disobeyed his orders to launch against us. He said, no, it can't be. And he refused. They thought that we had launched against them. And he was ordered launch. And he didn't do it. Saved the world. What did he do? What did they do with him? They sent him to Siberia, naturally. And then an American foundation came to the rescue and gave him $1,500. Well, that's what you get for saving the world, Jan.
$1,500.
Yeah.
And a trip to Siberia.
And a trip to Siberia. So the next guy's not going to say, well, I don't think I'll launch. The next guy's going to launch, Dad.
Right. Well, I guess it doesn't matter if they kill you or do whatever. You're dead anyway at that point. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well,
that's right.
Let me ask you. Let's go into some of these older economists. Who is Adam Smith, and why was he wrong? And let me ask you. Well, let me ask you. Why is his work, if it's wrong, why is it paraded around by economists today as being correct?
Well, that's a good question. I wish I knew the full answer for sure. Adam Smith is the father of economics. He wrote one book on it called The Wealth of Nations. That's a short title. And it puts forward much of economics as practiced today still. I mean, they've advanced in some ways and they correct parts of it. I read it from the point of view of money systems because that's the only way I had to focus on the reading. What was the relevance for money systems? Adam Smith goes completely backward in the definition of money. You've got Aristotle and his science of money, where money is a creature of the law. Smith's definition of money is of gold, of money, is gold or silver by weight. By weight. That, in monetary studies, that's called, it's not even coinage. It's by weight. You understand? If a coin's clipped, he's only counting a part of it. By weight, the term that described that was called ponderata, Latin, I guess, for weight. That is where the concept of money was in England before the Romans conquered England. He took the concept of money backward to that point, whereas the Bank of England, which he strongly supported, had advanced forward to fiat money, but unfortunately privately created fiat money. And they did that not in theory. They were still pretending gold. They did it in practice. Now, if you apply Adam Smith's theory to their practice, you would end up with mystery. It doesn't explain, you see, it doesn't compute.
Right.
And so he protected in a big way the private Bank of England. He never directed any attention to the fact that it was privately owned, privately controlled. In fact, the terminology he uses does the opposite. He said it functions like a, quote, like a great engine of state, unquote. This is horrible. Why did he do it? Why? Well, and by the way, this is focused on in chapter 12 of my book, where we analyze Adam Smith in real detail. We don't know why he did it. We're not mind readers. What we do know is that his patron, the Duke of Buccleuch, B-E-U-C-C-L-E-U-G-H, who was the largest landowner in Scotland, that family had just recently intermarried with the House of Montague, which was the power behind the Bank of England. So that may have been the reason. The other reason, his book's published in 1776, and, well, that's a year after we used our money system, our power to create money, the Continentals, to be successful in our fight against Great Britain or to carry the fight on. Eventually, it enabled us to beat the strongest power on the planet at the time. And what did we get out of it? We got America out of it. Another example, when the Continental Currency gave us the nation, the greenbacks let us keep it as one nation. So America's been a country of fiat paper money, of real money, from the beginning. Without it, there is no America. If the ideas of Adam Smith had been followed, and he is the arch enemy of government-issued money, if his ideas, or the ideas of what is today called the Austrian School of Economics, a bunch of monetary butchers, actually, not that I have anything against butchers. Butchers are fine people. But they do not, they have not done their monetary homework. this is the only critique or criticism I would ever have of Ron Paul. He believes that they've done their homework, and we know that they haven't.
What about Karl Marx? Why was he incorrect?
Karl Marx just echoed Adam Smith on gold and silver. He's just an economist. He got some things right regarding history. He did more history, I think, and more accurately than Adam Smith did. But, you know, there are three or four books that that comprise Karl Marx's Capitalism. What's the name of his book? Kapital, Das Kapital. And the first book was actually written by him, but none of the others were. The second book was written by Engels, and the third one by somebody called Kautsky, and the fourth one by an American who translated something. And what these guys all said were, yeah, we used Marx's notes, but they were unreadable. All this is described in my book.
So
Marx tried to do it a little bit more from the heart, and he tried to do it a little bit more from the labor point of view. But once he screwed up the definition of money, all was lost. Because that's been the mechanism through which the money power has been captured from society. And again, back to our basic rule, whoever controls the money system over time controls the nation. You can't expect them to control it for the common good.
And that really explains a lot of what's wrong with current economists' point of view. They're basing their work on non-historical biased information by people that were either controlling it or intentionally lied or were ignorant.
Yes. That's it. That's correct. Absolutely correct. Now, Jan, we've gone about 48 minutes.
Right.
And I'm in the middle of making sure that our conference is planned well. And as we agreed, I'm going to do the other half of this
right
after the conference, and I'm looking forward to that. You've had some of the most intelligent questions I've ever been asked.
Well, I appreciate that.
No, I appreciate it.
Well, and I appreciate you taking this long as well. I was going to try and push you for a few more, but I think this is a good place to stop, and then we'll just pick up right where we left off. What day is your seminar again?
Oh, it's September 24th through 27th. It's at Roosevelt University in downtown Chicago. People are still able to come. If they go to our website, they can find the registration sheet. If they register by Monday night, they get in at a discount. Otherwise, well, it's about $295 to attend. It's 4 days, and they get materials, and we have a gala dinner. They get served breakfast every day at and coffee breaks, things like that, and then we have a beach barbecue after it's all over.
Well, I have a friend who's going to be there, so maybe I'll get him to get him to carry a recorder and bring back some of that great information for your next interview with me as well.
Tell him to bring friends.
There you go.
There's still room.
All right,
Stephen. Thanks a lot, Jan.
You're welcome, and I'll talk to you
soon.
Good
luck to you there.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.